Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Cubs are atop the world of baseball. Britain is blocked from Brexit, and the United States is on the verge of electing a new president. Here we are, though, in the Media Project, posh studios at WAMC, ready for another half hour of media commentary. And you'll just have to put off the other stuff for a while as we go along in our little way. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with my colleagues Rosemary Armeo, the investigative journalist and head of the journalism program at the University of Albany.
Hello.
There she is. Hello. And Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO here of Northeast Public Radio.
Sir. Hi, Chief.
Hey, don't call me Chief. That was, sorry for those of you old enough to remember.
I knew you were going to do that.
Televised Superman. It was a great show. That was a great show back in the golden era of journalism. So anyway, we have a lot of news in the world of the media. You know, there's still a lot of turmoil in our midst in the traditional media world over downsizing. The Wall Street Journal is significantly downsizing, probably cutting by two-thirds its Greater New York section, which was its challenge launched 7 years ago to the New York Times. Has been doing a lot of great New York State coverage. That's going to be gone. Gannett, most significantly, downsizing. 300 more journalists losing their jobs, including, as we talked about last week, our great friend Stu Shinsky, who will be back in front of these microphones in a couple of weeks, the editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal.
We love him.
In Gannett's case, interesting development. Gannett has been trying for a year to buy the newspapers of Tribune Company, now known as Tronc, with a lowercase t, Tronc. And Gannett has given up. Tronc has decided that they're going to hold on to the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, the Hartford Courant, Baltimore Sun, some of the other great papers that have been in their stable. Question is, what does this mean? Is this good news?
Well, you know, I have to say that I've never understood all of this. It was my understanding, by the way, that it was the Gannett people who pulled out, not the Tronc people who decided to hold on to what they had. Look, here's the thing about Gannett. They were about to take on what we hear was about $800 million in debt. That's a lot of money. At the same time, in order to garner all of those resources, they started downsizing their profitable, and I want to talk about profitable, newspapers. So you get something like the Poughkeepsie Journal, which I believe is sort of slated to be the stepchild of the White Plains paper. And now, as they're pulling out to save face, they say, we've decided to put our money into the papers that which are already profit centers. Well, why did you start fooling around with the $800 million in debt, which you know if when you buy all of those newspapers, whether they're L.A. or whatever, that they're going to not make money? That's what this is all about. Newspapers aren't making money. So I didn't get that whole deal from the very beginning.
Aren't making enough money for their owners is the issue. Yeah. If you have a heavily leveraged company that has a lot of debt, they're not making enough money to pay off all that debt. And that's what happened. Gannett has now 109 communities where they have newspapers around the country. They have a lot of debt, and they're profitable newspapers, just not profitable enough. You know.
Well, to put it mildly, is anything ever enough?
I mean, good question.
You ask any billionaire in the world and say, is it enough what you've got? They couldn't possibly spend it. They can't put it in a casket with them, but it's never enough.
Yeah, but supermarkets operate at a margin of less than 2%, so you can make money on high-volume, low-margin business. And so you have to think.
Thanks to Alan Neurath of Gannett. He's now passed on, but he left a terrible legacy, and that was that newspapers had to make 25% in every quarter. And if they didn't, there were ruinous cuts to the very thing that the newspaper was selling, its editorial product.
Mm-hmm. So you've been
downsized.
You've been somebody who has had a real down feeling about Gannett itself, right?
I mean, I am not an admirer of Gannett. I think they're famous for the ruination of the business model. They kind of, it might have come anyway. The internet and all of that was new, but they certainly didn't help to shore up the business model for newspapers. And then there's USA Today, which is their big project. And yes, they have very nice weather maps. Wow, that's really helped the news business.
Right.
Well, they do have some good reporting. I mean, for example, it was USA Today that really did this deep dive into the legal troubles of Donald Trump that found that his 1,300 lawsuits, they pulled out. They have done some good Washington reporting, but the difficulty is that for newspapers, you know, our bread and butter has to be local reporting.
Sure.
And so if you roll up all this stuff into a single digital product, basically, with little bits of local thrown into it, and you have USA Today, what they now call the USA Today Network, all of these Gannett papers are a part of, what you're doing is you're sacrificing the local in support of the national. So basically, you've got all these little Gannett papers then competing against ABC and CBS and whoever else.
The local news network of Gannett was savaged and plundered, and people went to Washington. And the fact that Gannett sometimes does investigative reporting, hardly their stronghold, is more attributable to all the reporters from other places that have been put out of work by the business model that they have unleashed. Mm. And so, yeah, they can get some good people who do good work. That's how you get investigative reporters.
Well,
hire good people.
Sorry. I do read USA Today, personally. Every time I'm in a hotel.
It's like candy. Yeah, it's like candy. Mm-hmm. You just pick it up and didn't.
Yeah, you know, I check out the list of the top news story from each state because I lived
like
in a number of those states. That's kind of fun. You know what's going on in Texas, South Dakota. There's not much news out of South Dakota, you know, even though it's Al Newhart's home state and mine. But you can check out this stuff. And you have to be concerned about what's going to happen. Gannett just took over, for example, the record in Bergen County, New Jersey. It used to be known as the Bergen Record, which has been a wonderful
big paper
for many, many years. A great feeder to major metros like the New York Times and so on. And you have to worry what's going to happen. Gannett took that over in July and downsized. The Fayetteville Observer, owned by the same family for more than a century. What's going to happen to that paper under Gannett ownership?
Well, you know, what happens under the change is almost always the same. They gut all the best things, the local features, and require you to take the features that are put out by the chain. They're homogenized. So newspapers increasingly have no flavor, no local flavor. The local columnists are cut back. The local reporting is cut back. And you're going to run a feature that you might see in a paper halfway across the country. And management also goes in. I've watched this as a victim of these cuts. What's going to save newspapers? At first, it was newspaper redesign. So across the country, they went into these expensive redesigns that somehow are going to make a rectangle filled with squares of pictures and copy look different, and that was going to attract people. And then it was buying big, new, fancy buildings, which are now all being sold across the country. And increasingly, it seems to be mergers. And none of these things have brought the kind of economy of scale or efficiencies that supposedly are going to save the business. And what has consistently gone downhill is the quality of the local news coverage.
So nobody's thinking good over there. Is that your point? I mean, you know, they keep betting on the wrong horse. Rex, you said something I wanted to ask you about because I didn't understand it. You said that the Bergen Record was a feeder to the New York Times. Does that mean that the New York Times came along and stole their best reporters?
Sometimes. Yep. But also that their editor might be some, for example, their last great editor came from the New York Times to their table. So
that's more of a regurgitator than a feeder.
But there, you know, there are signs of life elsewhere. Sometimes the print really matters. You know, the Minneapolis Star Tribune now has a local owner, a local publisher, and they're making investments in that paper, and it's coming back. But they are finding that there is vitality still in print. The Star Tribune, which used to have 450 people in the newsroom, is now down to 250, so they can't cover everything they used to. But they are being thoughtful about where they invest, what they do with it, and the Star Tribune is giving Minneapolis a city where print matters. This is a city that has, like Albany, has among the highest print consumption in the country, the highest percentage of newspaper readership. And that's a place where they are actually managing to make a difference. One of the things that's most interesting about this trend is the New York Times, it turns out, their CEO claims that the New York Times can make money if there's no advertising in the print product. They say they see their future as being a consumer revenue-driven entity, a subscription-driven entity. Now, the Times is unique because they've got an international audience, but if you can sustain print without a lot of print advertising, maybe there's a path.
Well, look,
it's hard.
I've heard you and your colleagues argue that the way to do this is to charge for advertising on the net. turns out that that doesn't work.
Turns and you out, charge for subscriptions on the net. Yeah.
Well, not only for only for subscriptions, but also advertisers would be approached to do online what they've done in print. Well, that didn't turn out to be quite right because for some reason, the advertisers aren't willing to pay for the same eyeballs, more eyeballs than they were when it was on paper.
It's supply and demand. It's because the internet is virtually unlimited inventory available. There is an unlimited amount of advertising available to reach people, whereas in print, if you want to reach people in print in the capital region, you really have to buy the Times Union. So it's classic supply and demand. There's only a certain amount of supply available, so you can bid up the price a little bit, whereas in the internet, there is no such thing as a limit. There's no...
But I read the New York Times assiduously. I think it's a great newspaper. I have my issues with it, but I think it's a great newspaper. And a lot of people like me are reading it. And if you are to listen to you, a lot of people are buying your product or looking at your product either online or on paper. So it isn't quite supply and demand. I still want, if I'm an advertiser, to get to everybody the New York Times gets to, which is a lot of people. So how does that work out?
I think you misunderstood what I meant by supply and demand.
Wouldn't I'm be the first time.
About I'm just talking about, in general, internet advertising is inexpensive because it is ubiquitous. And so it's much cheaper. You get a much lower amount of money for the same number of eyeballs. And that makes it more difficult to get revenue out of it.
So now the big look is subscription. I subscribe to your paper. I subscribe to the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal whets my appetite every morning and says, here's four lines from our paper. Now you want more, pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still working out. Now, what are some of the models there, Rex, that we can look forward to? In other words, you buy a subscription and then you get it all you want. But how about those papers would say, okay, you want to see today's paper, you pay just for today's paper.
You can do that, but it's so cheap to buy a digital subscription, like $1 a week. So there's no reason to just buy today's paper. Buy your digital subscription for $1 or for $50 a year that way.
And well, I think that may be a little snotty on your part.
So really? How so?
Well, that's because you weren't listening carefully enough. So a dollar a week is $52 a year.
Correct.
Now, that's a lot of money for some people, right?
Well, and I'm sorry, but it's less than you would pay for a cup of coffee. You know, if knowing about the information in your community is not worth half a price of a cup of coffee one day, you know, if $1 a week is too high for somebody, then, you know, I'm sorry, but no. I can't give it away. I cannot give it away.
I understand
and sustain the business model. And, be, you know, and if we go away, where do you get your news? Where do you find out the news to put on WAMC if you don't have, newspapers,
is,
you know?
This is so...
Okay, now it's getting dirty. This now it's getting
reminds
dirty.
Reminds me of my old days on Fire Island. No, but I'm going to have... I had to do that at least once in the show.
Rosemary threatened him, ladies and gentlemen. If he brings out the Fire Island thing. Let's see.
No. I'm not done.
Tell us about Camp Rock.
Camp Rock's house? Yeah. Okay. But before we go to that important story and what happened in that chicken coop, I want to go back to what you were saying.
Oh.
Yes, Rex, I want to buy your paper and do.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, there's whatever the $52. I buy the New York Times, another $52. Now the Wall Street Journal wants another $52. And in order to get a certain kind of news, is there no limit, sir? Have you shame?
If you wanted three shirts, Alan, you'd pay three times. Why would you not pay for three different newspapers?
What?
Why is a newspaper a different product than a shirt or a pair of underpants? If you want one pair, you buy once. If you want three, you buy three pair.
There you go.
You pay three times.
I have three.
Well, that's good. So there you go. You paid. We're very glad to hear this. All right.
Well, you understand my point, though, is that now what's happening is the aggregators are coming along. So the aggregators put all of the newspaper stories that they have access to. In some cases, they don't have access.
Right.
And you like it because it brings another eyeball to your newspaper, right?
And once we install the paywall, a person clicks on the story that the aggregator puts there, and they run into our paywall, and they can give us $1 if they want the story, or if not, they
But that hasn't been done yet, right?
Not yet. We'll see.
That's interesting. I'm glad people are listening to the Media Project because they're going to learn something that they may not know.
You know, our best journalism is behind a paywall these days, but some of it is free. Some of the stuff is free. And generally, we'll give you a little clip of something, a little piece of. Sometimes we have really big stories that we leave outside the paywall. For example, and one of our readers from Selkirk, which is in Albany County, wrote about this, who was reading a story where the headline was Schenectady Cop Linked to Forgery Case, Gay Porn Industry.
Yeah.
Think about that headline.
I've been reading that story, too. That's a pretty amazing story.
A Schenectady cop. You don't often get to do a headline about a cop gay pornography and apparently forged checks to buy luxury cars. That's mm-hmm. a great story. That story we thought was so explosive, it would have so much interest that we left it outside the paywall because we thought it would be better for us in terms of getting eyeballs, that there'd be more, frankly, more revenue from the eyeballs.
So I know what that's like.
That's a lost leader.
Yeah.
You stole it right out of it.
Yay!
I hate it when you do that too much. You know?
I was going to say it's like a rotisserie chicken in the supermarket, a lost leader. You get it for $6 and then you stay around to buy the other stuff.
But our listener, Christopher in Schenectady, asks a good question. He was reading that story, he said, and I question the standard of, quote, did not immediately return calls seeking comment. And that is what our initial story said. The chief of police did not initially return calls seeking comment. And he said, for years, I always assumed 24 hours, the time it takes me to get back voicemails, emails, etc. However, in the days of shock journalism or lack of good journalism, what is that definition? And he says, would it be better to say the form of communication, when it was sent and how long you waited before publishing it? Maybe like, quote, the reporter left multiple calls starting at 6 a.m. on Tuesday and did not return calls by 9 p.m. before publishing. You know,
that's two paragraphs.
We teach that at journalism school. You don't.
Yes.
You cannot spend 6 months, for example, on an investigation and then call the target of that investigation
Friday
the
night.
Day before yeah. and say, okay, mm-hmm. we're going to press. What do you got to say?
That's
not ethical. It is not fair.
Well,
and you will find publications that will say after three letters and two telegrams and we camped on his door for a month, you know, we
but for the most part, that's not the way that it's
done. No, that is the most part. Occasionally you'll have it a different way.
No, occasionally. Almost, maybe my eyeballs aren't really working that well, but what I see is repeated calls were not answered.
That's definitely an old standard that's not used much.
You know,
As an editor, I won't let that go through. Even as a professor, I don't let students do that.
Well, you're a professor, all right, but there's no question about it. What you guys teach in journalism school may not be the common practice.
In this particular case, we probably should have been more specific in the initial story because what ended up happening is the second day we had to digitally explain that we had left messages for two police designated spokesmen, that is the PIOs, the public information officers, and we had called the cell phone of the public safety commissioner in Schenectady, and none of those people had returned our phone calls. So we had to specify that because the chief of police, who is below the public safety commissioner in Schenectady, he got upset. He got up in front of the microphones, and instead of talking about the substance of the story, he said, well, I was blindsided. The Times Union didn't call me. And it is true. The reporter handling the story did not, unfortunately, have the new chief's cell phone number, but did not immediately return calls seeking comment. We probably had about a four-hour span there where we were trying to get a response. Maybe 6 hours, actually, trying to get response from the Schenectady cops and got none. So, you know, you kind of think, what is the standard? When do you go ahead and go with the story? We went ahead with the story based upon the documentation that we had.
Just because you don't have a comment doesn't mean that when you get it later, you don't do another story.
Right.
And 24 hours, as this writer suggests, is good for some things, not for others. If we had a shooting in a paper I worked at once in a middle school, a child was shot by another student who wanted his jacket or his sneakers, and the superintendent of that school district was very rigid and would not take calls from reporters after school hours. Oh. We were not going to wait the next day. We called repeatedly. Yeah. We called all the people around him that we had numbers for and said, you've got to comment on this. This will be in the paper tomorrow. He had every warning, and his comment was mostly about how rude we were. And he looked incredibly stupid in the newspaper, and that was actually a result of trying to be fair to him, that you've got to talk to a superintendent in a case of a shooting. So it all depends. I think the rule has to be about fairness. Our student reporters at the Albany Student Press did a story about a summer program for the Equal Opportunity Program, which was seemingly very oppressive. And when they called to talk to the director of the program, they were shunted to the school's communication person, who took several days to set up a meeting. At first, did not want to have the director there, wanted the director's boss there. Finally, it's all arranged, and the story ran after that. And the students, of course, were very eager to get the story out. They were advised them heavily. We don't control them. We only advise them. It was like, no, wait for the comment.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, can I go back to that then, Rosemary? And I know that you and I are on different pages sometime. But as a lifelong professor myself, and I respect what you're doing. And
I think it, all right, I'm braced.
With all due respect.
With all due respect, I think it can be said, just to start this out, that both Rex and I were big adherents for your getting your job, and you know that. So
for
you
which
know,
I thank you. Know,
so we are very much on your side. That is my point. But I do think,
however, he says, yeah.
But I do think that there's a big difference. What political scientists will teach, I teach. Gerrymandering is disgraceful, yet the state legislature goes ahead and it gerrymanders like crazy. You teach what you consider to be ethical behavior on the part of the press. But if you read the New York Post or the Daily News sometime, you don't see the kinds of things that you espouse in a classroom as daily practice. That's what I'm saying.
I have no comment to that.
Here's an interesting piece. Here's a question that people have asked me about during this presidential campaign. We've gotten almost through this without mentioning the presidential race. Donald Trump is accused of raping a 13-year-old girl. Why haven't the media covered it, is the question. And this question is raised actually by the Huffington Post, who has done a story. You've seen little bits of, you've seen references
yes.
to this.
Yes.
It's a civil case. And people have said to me, why don't you cover this? So I, several months ago, I looked at the documentation in this case and discovered that it was a Jane Doe. That is, it's an anonymous claim filed in court. It's extraordinary to, I think it would be very difficult to give a great deal of credibility to an anonymous claim against a presidential candidate from a case that is from 1994. So we have not done anything about this, nor has the national media who covers him. But it's a difficult choice.
I think even this article by the Huffington Post is coy. It's a way to bring up the accusation and seemingly to be on a high horse. So we're not really covering it. We're covering the coverage of the case. It's yes. really bogus. It's not only a John Doe, but it's just not really credible. The woman was supposed to hold a press conference with her lawyer at 6 p.m. At the last minute, she cancels it because she says she and her supporters have been attacked online by trolls, and they're just too afraid. It just doesn't ring right.
And you look for, in cases like this, and this is typical reporting, you look, okay, who's the lawyer handling the case? In this case, it's a patent lawyer. A patent
right.
lawyer handling a 25-year-old rape case is, does not inspire confidence.
Okay, I wanted to just say that your paper, Rex, for example, has enthusiastically endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Our editorial page did say that, yes, indeed.
Yes. And yet, we are, all of us, used to getting letters from people who are naturally frustrated by this presidential election. For example, the Hillary supporters writing about Trump would get some the other way. And what are they saying? They're saying, you know, basically you're undermining Hillary's campaign because you're not effectively reporting on a story which you and Rosemary have just explained pretty well about why you're not doing more on it. And yet, quite frequently, I write back to people saying, don't have fights with your friends. So I've never quite understood why people go to the people they know to complain the way that they do, especially when it's an irrational position.
Well, you know, I think that the commentary on WAMC is very heavily
favorable. We don't endorse anybody.
Oh, come now.
No, we don't.
You don't officially endorse anybody, but
no.
The commentary on WAMC is quite heavily in favor of Hillary, and so your listenership is more heavily Hillary-focused, and people go to where they feel comfortable, as you said. So a lot of Trump supporters might be mad at Fox News for not being rigid enough in the support of,
I doubt it.
Of the Donald. You know, the conservative movement is deeply divided in this
yeah.
country now.
Yeah. I think Fox is losing people to the Breitbarts and
yeah.
Matt Drudge, who used to be very marginal or fringe.
Does Breitbart have a television channel?
No, not yet. They may after this election,
yeah.
headed by Donald Trump. But
assuming he's not President Trump.
So stay tuned for that, folks. Next week's show, we will come back post-election, and we'll have some more thoughts, right?
I may be in Galway, Ireland.
Galway, absolutely. Who knows? We will have more to say about all of this in the weeks ahead. So Rosemary Romeo, Alan Chartok, and Rex Smith, we are here. We are the Media Project. We'll be back for you on the other side of the election, folks. Thanks for joining us.
She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. Funny, Wall Street never has complained Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.